After a few years of decline, the government's improper payment rate jumped 14% in 2014. The Government Accountability Office says the increase comes from major programs including Medicare fee-for-service, Medicaid, the Earned Income Tax Credit, unemployment insurance, and the Supplemental Security Income. David Mader is the White House controller. He tells executive editor Jason Miller about some new steps to move that needle, get back into the right direction.
One of the things that we need to do this year, and we're about to sort of launch this initiative, is selectively talk to a couple of departments about additional analysis around the whole improper payments within their particular sphere of responsibility. We need to do, I think, a better job, and we're actually making some amendments to some OMB guidance along this line, is to see if additional analysis would help us better identify some of the root causes on why payments are improper. And so we're going to be working, we OMB are going to be working closely with several of the departments over the course of 15 to see if we can better understand what is driving the improper payment rate, and then stepping back and saying to ourselves, well, can we mitigate that risk, right? Because it is a risk. Can we mitigate that risk by changing business processes, introducing technology, bringing in new data to look at, and do we need some legislative fixes? And I think if you look at the president's budget over the last several years, there have been numerous requests for legislative changes that would help us then implement process changes and policy changes that we believe will help continue to drive down that improper rate.
I want to maybe touch upon the analysis piece a little bit more, because I think there's been a lot of success from the work the Recovery Act did. And I know the Recovery Board moved into the Government-Wide Accountability Transparency Board. The technology and the use behind that has really done a nice job of helping reduce the improper payments. Is that the type of thing you're going to say, could we expand those concepts that the Recovery Act used to other agencies? Or are you talking about maybe a different kind of analysis?
I think it's both. And I've been brief on the ROC. Early in my tenure here, I went over and spent a couple hours, and I looked at some of the work that they've done. And also in my private sector life, actually, I mentioned consulting with some firms where we, for one of our clients, were saying, gee, you know, you're looking at only your data. If we bring in third-party data, does that enrich the set of analysis? And the answer is yes. And some of the things that the ROC did was basically to take the government information, look at it differently, bring in other government information, and bring in third-party information. And when you bring in those additional data elements, it really allows you to do a different kind of analysis. And actually, I've seen, you know, actually firsthand that it improves then the performance. Treasury plays a really critical role in this whole improper payments arena with their Do Not Pay office. And they're enhancing the government-wide databases that they're able to bring together to provide. I mean, they're basically a shared service, right? Because they're basically saying to agencies, before you make a payment, bring us the identity of that payment and let us tell you through analysis whether there are any issues there and flag them. We don't know if there's an issue, but it could be. And then you, agency, you know, take the necessary action. So enhancing, and that's another example of requests for legislative help to allow Do Not Pay to expand those databases that they have available and to enhance then the analysis that they can do in support of agencies.
Even though the goal with improper payments is to get to zero, have no improper payments, we realize, I think, logically speaking, that may be nearly impossible to ever get to. I think people make mistakes. No one maybe does it on purpose. From your perspective, what is an acceptable goal for improper payments? What's the end goal we're looking at?
What's interesting is I think when we think about improper payments, we actually need to think about the three components, because improper payments are either intentional, administrative, unintentional errors. And they're actually, the other part of improper payments is defined as, you know, somebody didn't get what they were supposed to get. So it's an underpayment. And I think it's hard, Jason, to say, you know, a defined number. And that's why we're doing this deeper analysis. But I would say that, look, when it comes to fraud, intentional fraud against the U.S. government, we need to go after the bad actors. And we need to drive that number down, because not only are they breaking the law, but as importantly, they are taking away dollars that rightfully belong to other taxpayers. So when I think about improper payments, I think about it in those three buckets and say, you know, the people that are the bad actors, yeah, that should be like really zero. For the people that are not receiving what they should, we should figure out why they're not, because they're entitled to it under the law, and we need to help that. And then some of these programs are complex, and I believe there are always going to be sort of those unintentional administrative errors. You know, again, we should drive as close as we can to zero. But to me, I think you're inevitably going to have some of that sometime. But it's the bad actors and it's the underpayments that I think we need to correct. It's those, so the two ends of that.
Technology can obviously help with both sides of that. You can, you know, put together a workflow that will maybe point out, hey, did you mean to put this figure here? This seems to have a lot of zeros, too many zeros, or not enough zeros. And then the technology, obviously, when you talk about do not pay, can also work with bad actors. Is that the key here, or is it better training? Is it a workforce challenge? Obviously, it's a combination of a lot, but where's the one area that if you could put the focus on?
I think it's a continuing better use of technology. I mean, clearly, as I mentioned, you know, what's happened over the last 11 years that I was out of government, I mean, it's just sort of almost revolutionary, you know, how we can now move data around so much more easily. And the advancements in the analytical tools, and you mentioned the ROC. I mean, the ROC's a good example of, I mean, they've been using sort of leading edge, cutting edge data analytics. And we need to get that out to all agencies. You know, it shouldn't be just contained in the ROC or do not pay. And there are some agencies that have been, you know, out there doing that, you know, acquiring not only the software to do the analysis, but also going and getting the people, because there's a people too. I mean, this is a skill set. You know, you want people who are sophisticated data analysts who can merge a variety of different data sets, that can build the kinds of filters and algorithms that you want to put on the front end of a lot of these processes. So it's people, it's technology.
Let's move over to the next big issue. Risk management's a topic that I think is fascinating. You talked about it a couple of months ago as potentially some new guidance or direction or help to agencies to understand how to incorporate risk management from a broader perspective. And obviously there's an A-123 rewrite that's ongoing as well that will incorporate risk. Talk about where you're seeing that going over the next year.
With regard to risk and internal controls, I actually go back to, and I think this last year it was the 20th anniversary in 2014 of the CFO Act. And having worked in that community for the 20 years, I think from a financial management perspective, we've done a really good job. Yes, we still have material weaknesses, and yes, we still have, you know, challenges, but they're isolated challenges. And what we want to do is take the lessons learned from focusing internal controls and risk management in the financial world and step back and look at the complexity of a department and say, are there tools and techniques and lessons learned that we have in the financial community that we could actually now bring to the broader, let's say, mission side of an organization? And we're in the process of making some modifications to A-123. And I would suspect sometime this calendar year, we will be coming out with some broad guidance for departments to look at with regard to how do they want to structure a program that would give the secretary and the deputy secretary, who's the chief operating officer, the assurance that across the breadth of their particular department, recognizing just how diverse and complex those missions are, that those subcomponents are addressing risk and putting in place the requisite mitigation plans.
Several agencies, including the Treasury Department, have a risk management office already. Are you meeting, are there discussions going on? I think DOD has probably one as well, with those offices that exist to say, what do you do now? What can we borrow, beg, steal from you to apply maybe more broadly?
We've done an inventory of who has risk officers. And what's interesting is when you look across the landscape and you see the different organizations that have put in place risk officers, they put them in place for different reasons. And when you look at the scope, they have different scopes. And one of the things that we want to recognize is every department and every bureau is unique. And I don't think that when we are dealing with risk, we want to have this one-size-fits-all cookie cutter and just mandate everybody needs to have a risk officer. I think we need to leave it to the secretary and the deputy secretary to assess their particular situation against this framework that I'm describing and say, for me in Department X, it makes sense to have this kind of structure. And that kind of structure would be focused on the following things. I don't believe when you look at the complexity of any of the departments, you can say everybody should be the same. But we want everybody addressing issues and identifying risk and creating mitigation plans.
So it seems to me you haven't changed your tune around CROs, adding another C-suite person to the growing list of CIOs, CAOs, and et cetera, and go on. So no chief risk officer necessarily being mandated by OMB.
I mean, at this time, we're still exploring how we're going to roll this out. I mean, you've heard me speak in forums and conferences. I just want to give departments the flexibility to apply these principles in a way that makes sense. And sometimes if you just say, you have to have this, I'm not sure it will meet the needs of a particular department.
When you talk about this framework, and I know it's still under development, it's still maybe in the early part of thinking, but what types of things could you see being brought in from the internal controls? Because mission is so different. You know, USDA has a different mission than Interior, which has a different mission than Commerce, yet how do you write a framework that makes sense to everybody?
We can lift up some of the specificity that we had around particular internal control segments within financial services. And I do think you can make that translation into the mission. Again, I think it's going to be higher level, more general. And again, I want to emphasize, I think it needs to be more general just because of the diversity of what we're dealing with when you look across the breadth of the government.